Okay, it's a pleasure to welcome back. It's been a long time since Rabbi Weinberg, who's a landslide, who had come from the same country, almost the same country. You know, not everybody considers Montreal exactly the same country, but Rabbi Weinberg grew up in Montreal. His family still lives in Montreal, but he, of course, is the rabbi in Kemp Mill Synagogue in Kemp Mill, Maryland, and doing a wonderful job. He's a graduate of Yeshiva University with a master's degree in Azrieli, and it's really a pleasure to welcome him back to Torah in Motion. Bakasha, Rabbi Weinberg.
Thank you so much for having me back. It's really an honor to be here. Thank you, Rabbi Kelman, for inviting me and for all that you do and the Torah in Motion does for the sake of the Jewish people and spreading of Torah. It's very, very interesting to watch. I get your emails and it's wonderful to follow all the fantastic programs that you're doing. It really feels nice to connect to other Jews, especially during this time of COVID, to connect to Jews across the border, and especially to connect around the experience of learning Torah together. So I very much value this opportunity, and I'm excited to learn with all of you here tonight. One of the themes of Parshas Vayechi, with the death of Yaakov, which we see in this week's Parsha, is of course the theme of succession and of leadership. The truth of the matter is, it's not just the theme of Parshas Vayechi, but it's the theme of the last few Parshios in the Torah, already from Vayeshev and on until the end of Sefer Bereshit. It's really the theme that preoccupies the backdrop of a lot of these Parshios. Actually, one could argue that it's actually the theme of the entirety of Sefer Bereshit, is really the theme of leadership and succession. The Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, in his introduction to Sefer Bereshit, really casts the whole theme of the book in this way. But it's certainly the theme of the end couple of Parshiot, and it's definitely the theme of Parshat Vayechi, and therefore leadership and succession is something that I want to take a look at tonight with all of you. In every time, in every place, in every era in history, I think people have been preoccupied with the theme of leadership. People have recognized the importance of leaders, sometimes criticizing leaders, but also recognizing the importance. Everybody who criticizes a leader is implicitly recognizing that a leader has a capacity to change and to shape the destiny of a community, the destiny of a country, the destiny of humanity. That's why they're criticized, right? So everyone, for the course of history, has always been preoccupied with leadership, recognizing the ability of a strong and charismatic leader to take us from point A to point B, to make us better people, to shape our experience, to help us succeed, to allow us to live, and of course, to help us to overcome all the vicissitudes of life. People in every era have written guidebooks about their vision of leadership and how to achieve it. From Plato's Republic to Machiavelli's The Prince to even up to today, Stephen Covey's Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. They all call it different things. They all approach it in slightly different ways. They may not call it leadership. They may not call it a guidebook. They may not call it self-help, whatever they're going to call it. But in essence, they're all writing about what it means to be a leader and what it means to have a leader in your midst. And it's not just people over the course of history, but the Torah itself recognizes the impact that a leader can have on their surroundings and that the loss of a leader can have upon a society or a community. I'm going to bring up the source sheet, which I think you probably have access to as well, but I'll bring it up here on my screen. So if you take a look in the Torah, various incidents seem to speak to this point about recognizing how leadership can make an impact or lack thereof. When Avram Avinu dies in Parshas Chayesar, the Gemara in Baba Basra, here in source number 2, has a very beautiful statement about the world's reaction to the loss of Avram Avinu. Amar Rav Chanan bar Rava Amar Rav. Rav Chanan bar Rava says in the name of Rav, Oso hayom shenifta Avram Avinu min ha'olam. When Avram Avinu, the Av Hamon Goyim, the iconoclast, the monotheist, the leader par excellence of his time, when he died on that very day, Amdu Kol Gedolei Umos HaOlam B'Shura VeAmru. All the great leaders of the nations of the world at the time stood in a row and they said, Oy la LaOlam Sha'avad Manhigo, V'Oy la LaSfina Sha'avad Karbarnita. Oh, woe is to the world that lost its leader. Woe is to the ship that lost its captain. They viewed Avram Avinu as a leader, as a captain of a ship, steering the ship, they felt with his loss, they felt rudderless. They felt motionless. They felt lost. That's what it means to lose a leader. When Yaakov leaves Beersheba, he runs away from his parents' home, beginning of Parshas Vayetze. The pasuk here in source 3 says, Vayetze Yaakov mi Beersheba, Vayelech Charana. Yaakov left Beersheba and he went to Haran. Rashi in source number 4 asks the classic question. We know where Yaakov was leaving from. Why did the Torah have to tell us where he was leaving from and where he was going to? Lo hayatzarich lichtov ela vayelech Yaakov Haran. The pasuk could have just started and said, Yaakov left to go to Haran. Lama hizkir yitziyaso. Why does it say he left from Beersheba? Ella, rather, what is the Torah teaching us in this critical moment? Magid shi yitziyas tzarik min hamakom oser roshem. When a leader leaves a place, it makes an impact. Shebishman shi atzarik ba'ir, hu hoda. Who Ziva? Who Hadara? So long as the leader personality is within the midst of the city, that leader is what contributes to the splendor of the city, to the beauty of the city, to the radiance of the city. Yatza Misham, Pana Hoda, Pana Ziva, Pana Hadara. When that person leaves, there is a tangible impact. The loss of a leader not only creates confusion, but there's a diminution in the radiance of a society, in the radiance of the people. This is a recognition that leadership is important. And of course, in our parsha, Vayechi Yaakov Eretz Mitzrayim Shvayesrei Shana, the parsha begins talking about Yaakov's life in Egypt and eventually leading to Yaakov's death. And Rashi points out that this is a parsha stuma. In the Torah, you have space between different parshios, not the parshios we know, Bereishis, Shmos, you know, Lech Lecha, Vayera, but the sections of the Torah are cordoned off by space, and sometimes the parsha psucha, and sometimes it's stuma. Sometimes it's an open break, and sometimes it's a closed break. Sometimes it's a break at the end of a line, and then you have a new line that begins. Sometimes in the midst of a line, you have a little bit of space. So Vayechi is a parsha stuma. It's a closed parsha. And homiletically, Rashi, based on the Medrash, explains, why is it closed? Why is the parsha that describes the death of Yaakov a closed parsha? Lefi shekevan sheniftar Yaakov avinu, nistemu einehem velibam shel Yisrael mitzaras hashibud, sheyischilu l'shabdam. Because just as the parsha's closed, with the death of Yaakov, the eyes of the Jewish people became closed. They started to suffer the sufferings of exile, of slavery, of Egyptian life. Now you have to ask yourself, wait a second. When Yaakov dies, they don't enter slavery. They don't enter slavery until much later, till the death of Yosef and the other tribes. So what is Rashi talking about here? How could it be that their eyes were closed, that they suddenly felt the difficulties of slavery? What Rashi must be suggesting here is not that they literally started to become enslaved, but without a leader to guide them, without the radiance of a leader like Yaakov in their midst, the distress of the future, the unknowns of the future, the uncertainty of the future became almost unbearable for them. With a leader can raise a people above that. He can give them hope and confidence and radiance and structure. Without that leader, people become rudderless, like those who face the death of Avram Avinu. People lose their radiance, like we see with the exit of Yaakov from his city. People become distressed, like we see here in our parsha with the death of Yaakov. Of course, we know the quintessential moment of the passing on of leadership is at the death of Moshe Rabbeinu. Also, the Torah recognizes the importance of leadership in that moment. Moshe Rabbeinu comes to Hashem, Parshas Pinchas, source number 7, and he says, please, I know I'm not going to go into the land. I know I'm going to die, but please, Yifkod Hashem Elokei HaRuchos V'chol Basar Ish Al Ha'eda. Please appoint a new leader to the Jewish people. Asher Yitzei Lifnehem, V'asher Yavo Lifnehem, Asher Yotziem, Asher Yivyim. Someone to go in front of them, someone to take them, someone to bring them back. Why? V'lo Tiyeh Adas Hashem Katzon Asher Ein Lahem Ro'eh. So that the people shouldn't be like a flock without a shepherd. Again, recognizing that without a strong leader, people become rudderless. People become lost. People can spread out in all directions. People can lose their whole mission, their whole impact, their whole cohesiveness. I think over and over you see that the Torah recognizes the strength of a leader to do wonders for a people and the impact that the loss of a leader can have upon a people as well. Today, I believe, and you could disagree with me if you like, but I think we live in a time when we experience a dearth of leadership, a real dearth of leadership in various areas of life, whether in politics, to religious life, to communal life. I don't mean to be political here at all, please, at all. But just take a look at the last American election, last two American elections. You could have a lot of people, very creative, very talented politicians. But do you really see a pipeline of true, discernible, incredible leaders waiting to take over, either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, whatever, across the aisle? It's not meant to be a political statement, but I think everyone would recognize that there is no pipeline of tremendous leaders lying in wait to take over from the previous generation. You see it also in religious life. I really believe this. You see, you know, Gedolei Yisrael, the great figures of the Jewish people, you know, are aging. They're entering their 80s, their 90s, the great leaders of our generation. And I don't see a clear pipeline of new leaders coming up the pike, ready to take over. There's a dearth of leadership. There's many wonderful people out there, but being a great person is different than being a leader. You see it in communal life as well. I don't know how shuls are in Toronto or anywhere else, but I can tell you in my shul, we have wonderful, wonderful people, always ready to step up and volunteer. Really, truthfully, for any task, I could have dozens of people who are ready to do it, ready to help, ready to try, but ask them to be the leader of the group? Ask them to take the position of the head of the committee? Oh, no, 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 not for me, not for me. They're willing to help, they're willing to do, but to be the leader is an entirely different question. I see a dearth of leadership in so many areas of life. I'll show you just a couple of interesting quotes back to our source sheet over here. I'm sure you all feel this intuitively. This is already an old source, but David Grossman, who does have certain interesting political connections, but the Israeli author, journalist, he said in 2007, this is after the Lebanon War, which unfortunately he lost his son in that war. But he says, one of the toughest issues that the recent war has sharpened is the feeling that in these days there is no king in Israel, that our leadership is hollow. I'm not even talking about the visible failures in the conduct of war, not about corruptions, large and small. I'm talking about the inability of Israel's current leaders to connect Israelis to their identity, to those parts of our identity, memory, and founding values that will give us hope and strength, that will give some significance to the exhausting, despairing struggle for survival. It's such a beautiful quote. I think a very apt quote. It's not talking about any leaders and their failures, what they did right, what they did wrong, whether they're capable, not capable. There's something people are looking for, yearning for in a leader. That is to connect people to their identity, to raise them up, to give them direction. And we don't see leaders who are truly capable of doing that today, by and large. Another quote here, source number 9, also an old quote. You can tell when I pulled these quotes, 2007. More than 3/4 of Americans believe that there is a leadership crisis in this country. I'm sure if they said it in 2007, they say it today too. And that without better leadership in all sectors, the country will continue on a downward course. Very sad statement about the dearth of leadership. Dr. Brené Brown, who's quite well known, people probably know her for her book, Daring Greatly, her famous TED Talk, talking about vulnerability and leadership. She talks about in her book, Dare to Lead, she talks about this crisis of leadership. We started our interviews with senior leaders with one question. What, if anything, about the way people are leading today need to change in order for leaders to be successful in a complex, rapidly changing environment where we're faced with seemingly intractable challenges and an insatiable demand? There was one answer across the interviews. We need braver leaders and more courageous cultures. When we followed up to understand the specific why behind the call for braver leadership, the research took a critical turn. Sorry for the typo. There wasn't just one answer. There were close to 50 answers, and many of them weren't intuitively connected to courage. Leaders talked about everything from critical thinking and the ability to synthesize and analyze information, to building trust, rethinking educational systems, inspiring innovation, finding common political ground amid growing polarization, making tough decisions, importance of empathy, relationship building, on and on and on. What I wanted to show in this quote from Brené Brown is, people feel the lack of leadership. They want their leaders to have courage. But when you ask them why or what it looks like, it's here, it's here, it's here. It's all over the place. We don't even know what we're looking for, but we recognize that something is missing. Something critically important is missing. Leadership and the ability to cultivate leadership and cultivate new leaders, especially amongst our young people, is a very important topic. I feel we're lacking it in our generation today. And tonight, I'd like to open the topic a little bit by looking at two models of Jewish leadership through the lens of the first Jewish family, the family of Yaakov Avinu, and explore some of these models together with you. So if you think about the whole trajectory of the first Jewish family from Avram Avinu all the way to Yaakov in our Parsha, Rabbi Menachem Liebtag has his famous essay in which he explains that there's a selection process in every generation. There's a weeding out, what he calls a bechira process, a choosing process in every generation as you go forward. So in the generation of Avraham, Yitzchak is the one who's chosen. Ishmael and Bnei Keturah are the one who are rejected. In Yitzchak's generation, Yaakov is the one that's chosen. Esav is the one that's rejected. There's always multiple children. Some are rejected, some are accepted. It's a weeding out, a selection process in order to shape the leadership channel of this family, the trajectory of this family. So it goes Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. But, of course, by the time you get to Yaakov, you have 12 tribes that emerge from Yaakov, the Bnei Yaakov, at which point you see the Bechira process come to an end. All of the children of Yaakov are accepted. There is no weeding out. There is no selection process when it comes to them. And that you see already reflected in the Psukim. If you look in Parshas Vayishlach, after we read about the birth of Binyamin and the death, unfortunately, of Rachel, the Pasuk says at that point, here in a Parsha Psucha, an open Parsha actually in the middle of a Pasuk, the Pasuk splits in the middle and begins a new section, Vayu Bnei Yaakov Shneim Asar. The children of Yaakov became 12. Now, Rashi points out that the Torah waited all this time till the birth of Binyamin to say that Yaakov had 12 children at all, implicitly recognizing that until you had all 12, you essentially had nothing, meaning implicitly recognizing that the 12 are a unit, the 12 are a group, the 12 go together. They will all be accepted. They will all be the future of this family. There's no more selection process. Like Rashi says here, the Yubnei Yaakov Shnei Masar, Maschli Inyan Rishon, it goes back to the original story of the death of Rachel, the birth of Binyamin. Mishanola Binyamin, Nishlama Hamita. After the birth of Binyamin, Yaakov's offspring were considered complete. They were well-rounded. They were done. The 12 tribes are considered one unit. That's confirmed in our Parsha. In our Parsha, after Yaakov gives all the brachos to his children, which we're going to talk about more extensively as we go forward in the shiur tonight, the Pasuk tells us, after all the brachos are given, Kol Eila Shifte Yisrael Shnei Masar. Now we know, we can all count, you go through the brachos of Yaakov, you know, there was 12 children, there was 12 brachos, there were 12 tribes, I should say, there was 12 brachos. So why does the Torah reiterate here? And in summation, all of these are the 12 tribes of Israel. And this is what their father spoke to them. Vayavarech Osam, he blesses them. Ish asher kevir chaso, beirach Osam. Every person gets his bracha. He blessed them. So Rashi says here, what does it mean? Ish kevir chaso, beirach Osam. Lo haya lomar ela ish asher kevir chaso, beirach Oso. It should have said their father gave every one of them a blessing. His blessing, not their blessing. Why does it go from singular, ish kevir chaso, every person according to his bracha, beirach, he blessed. It should have been oso, not osam, them. Why does it go from singular to plural? Ma tam lo beirach osam? Lefisha Nasam Yehuda Gvuraso Shel Aryeh Ula Binyamin Chatifaso Shel Ze'ev Naftali Kaluso Shel Ayal Yachol Shelo Kilan Bechol HaBrachos Tamun Lomar Berach Osam. Once you see the individualized brachos of every tribe gets this blessing, this particular, that particular. Could you really imagine that there's no collective blessing for them? No, of course not. Therefore, the pasuk has to reinforce, number one, kol eila shivtei Yisrael shnei asar. This is a unit. These 12 tribes, you can count them out yourself, but we're telling you, these are the 12 tribes because we want to reinforce to you they are a unit. And even though Yaakov gives every one of them the unique brachos that they get, in the end of the day, he was Beirach Osam. He blesses them as a unit, because they are a unit. They go together. There's no more selection process. The group is the group. It's set. It's done. They're all accepted into the fold of the future progenitors of the Jewish people. Now, while we see the selection process in terms of, you know, the chart of leadership going all the way from Avram down to Yaakov, we see selection, selection, selection. Now we get to Yaakov and they're all accepted. There's no more selection. Despite the fact that the 12 are all accepted, even amongst the 12, there still needs to be a leader. Either there needs to be a leader or there can be a leader or naturally there would be a leader, right? There's always someone who emerges as the leader, even when everybody's accepted into the fold. It would be natural in a family, especially like this, especially understanding the history of the family, the first Jewish family, that the Bechor, the firstborn, would emerge as the natural leader of the family. And in this case, there are two Bechors, because Yaakov had multiple wives. He had four wives. The two Pilagshim, the two maidservants, are not considered on the same level as the wives, but Leah and Rachel are the two, you know, main wives of Yaakov. And each of them have a firstborn. So the firstborn of Leah is Reuven. The firstborn of Rachel is Yosef. So just at face value on the surface, one would imagine if now you have all 12 accepted, one of them is going to emerge as a leader. Who is it going to be? It's probably going to be the Bechor. And since they're two, it will probably be both of them, Reuven and Yosef. That would be the natural assumption going in to our Parsha. Now, what you end up seeing in the end of Parshas Vayishlach is that Reuven, who's one of those two Bechors, loses his status after switching his father's bed after the death of Rachel. And we see that more clearly. It's not clear in our Psukim that he loses his Bechor status. It's clear from the Brachos in Parshas Vayechi, which we read in this coming week's Parsha, that Yaakov was upset about it and he criticized Reuven about it. But it's not clear from the original Psukim or even from the Psukim in Vayechi that Reuven loses his Bechor status. But if you look in Divrei Yamim at the description of Reuven, it's very clear over there, certainly in later sources, that Reuven is demoted in some way because of the act of switching his father's bed, trying to get his mother a more prominent position, meddling in his father's very private affairs after the death of Rachel. So Reuven loses his Bechor status. And therefore, Yosef, in theory, becomes the de facto leader of the Jewish people at this point. He becomes the de facto heir to the Bechor status, to the firstborn status, which would be the natural leader of the family. And actually, it's fascinating to see. If you look in the Psukim, I didn't bring them here for you in the correct order, but if you look at the Psukim, almost immediately after learning the story of Reuven switching the beds, which is the story that according to us is where he loses his status as the leader, as the Bechor, almost immediately jumps, with a little detour, but almost immediately jumps to the next parsha of Vayeshev, which opens in the following way. Vayeshev Yaakov Eretz Mugrei Aviv Eretz Kanan. Yaakov dwells in the land of his forefathers after he comes back from Laban's house. And it says, Ela Toldos Yaakov. Here are the Toldos, the offspring of Yaakov. Colon. Yosef ben 17 shana haya ro'ez echad batzon. Yosef, who was 17 years old, was shepherding his brothers who were looking after the flocks, who naras bnei bilha bnei, etc., etc. Now, what's wrong with this pasuk? If it's saying Eila toldos Yaakov, these are the offspring of Yaakov, it should have mentioned all of the children, and yet it immediately jumps to Yosef alone, as if to say, okay. We had two incumbents for the leadership of the Jewish people, Reuven and Yosef. in the previous psukim, just a little bit earlier, Reuven loses his status. And now, if we're going to ask the question of Ela Toldos Yaakov, who are the true leaders of the offspring of Yaakov, not who are all the offspring, who's the leader? Who's the one who's going to take the offspring of Yaakov into the next generation? The answer of the Torah is very clear. Yosef, Ben Shrei Seishana, Yosef. In fact, Rashi says here on this pasuk, he raises the question, how could Toldos Yaakov only point to one of the children, Yosef? So first he says, maybe Toldos is not really offspring. Maybe it's the events of their lives, and therefore it goes to talk about the main event of his life, which is Yosef and his sale into slavery, et cetera, et cetera. But then he says another interpretation, Umedrash Agada Doresh, Tala HaKasav Toldos Yaakov B'Yosef Mipnei Kama Devarim. The Torah hinged the entirety of the offspring of Yaakov onto Yosef alone for a few reasons. Achas, number one, Shekol Itzumo Atzmo Shel Yaakov Lo Avad Etzal Lavan Ela Berachel. The whole purpose of serving Lavan all those years in exile was for Rachel. V'shaya Ziv Ikonen Shel Yosef Domelo. That's number one. Number two, the whole visage, the whole face, the look of Yosef was similar to him. And three, Kol Mash Ira LeYaakov Ira LeYosef. The events of their lives were very similar. Essentially, Rashi is saying that Yosef is the main heir to the mantle of leadership of the family, and that is what the Torah is conveying in this pasuk. After Reuven loses his status, Yosef emerges as the leader over here of the family for a variety of reasons. And it's not by accident that the Torah says, Ela Toldos Yaakov, and only gives one child as the answer, Yosef, because although he has 12 tribes, Yosef is the one who's going to be the natural leader. However, despite that very clear sort of surface level understanding of the process leading up to these parshios, in which we distill and distill and distill, and then we get 12, and of the 12, one emerges as the natural leader, Yosef. Despite that, what you see for the rest of Parshas Vayeshev, after we have that statement, Ela Toldos Yaakov, Yosef, despite singling out Yosef, what you see from the rest of Vayeshev and the rest of the parshios till the end of Sefer Bereishis is that it's not the story of Yosef alone. It's not at all the story of Yosef alone who emerges as the leader, but it's the story of Yosef and Yehuda together that constitute the crux of Toldos Yaakov, the crux of the leadership of the Jewish people. In fact, if you follow through the storyline, their stories going forward from Vayeshev on are remarkably, remarkably similar. If you just look at the basic outline of their stories, Yehuda, after this point in the Parsha, after the sale of Yosef, Yehuda has an ill-fated marriage to Bathsheba. Yosef in Egypt has an ill-fated marriage, you'll call it marriage, union, trouble, tension, with a female partner, Eshes Potiphar. Then Yehuda emerges from that experience of a failed marriage with Bathsheba in some way to a good marriage in some way. All these are complicated, but in some way, a good marriage with Tamar. And Yosef emerges from his tension with Eshes Potiphar to a good marriage with Osnat. From those two unions, Yehuda has twins, Peretz and Zarach, one older, one younger. Yosef has two children, according to the Seder Hadoros, also twins, according to others not, Menashe and Ephraim, also an older and a younger. And then, almost in a remarkably similar way, Yehuda's sons, Peretz and Zarach, Peretz eclipses Zarach for the Bechorah. And in Yosef's case, Ephraim eclipses Menashe for power and royalty when Yaakov switches his hands for the brachos. It's almost the identical story. They're living the similar life, the similar storyline, almost in parallel. And not only that, do they take up the center of attention in all these parshios, Vayeshev, Miketz, Vayigash, Vayechi, they're the center of attention, number one. They're the prime storyline, number one. Number two, their storylines are identical. They're remarkably, remarkably similar, at least. And number three, when you get to our parsha of Vayechi, which is sort of the end of the story, when Yaakov gives all the brachos, the fact that Yosef and Yehuda stand out from the rest becomes so evident, so clear. As Yaakov starts to bless his children, the centerpiece of Parshas Vayechi, which we're going to read this Shabbos, you see that all of the tribes basically get a one-line bracha, maybe a two-line bracha. Reuven b'choriata, kochi reishis oni, yeter fsed v'yeter az, pachas kamayim al-totari, gets two psukim. Fine. Shimon and Levi also, they get three psukim. Fine. The only reason Reuven and Shimon get two or three psukim is because there's a storyline being described here. Reuven, in terms of the story of switching the bed, Shimon and Levi, their attack on Shechem. So there's a storyline attached to the bracha. There's a reason for the bracha, so it's elaborated upon a little bit. But really, their brachas are a one-liner, truthfully. Certainly, Zvulun, Yisachar, Dan, God, these are very short brachos. Asher, Naphtali, these are one-liners. It's hardly even a pasuk. Look at God. God, Gedud, Yegudenu, Vehu, Yagud, Akev. It's a throwaway. It's a tiny, tiny statement. And even if they get two psukim, it's okay. It's two psukim. These are really very small statements about all of their brachos. There are two exceptions, and that is Yehuda and Yosef. Yehuda here, I indented it so you could see, gets five psukim. Yosef over here gets four psukim. And not only four short psukim or five short, long psukim, big, elaborate stories, blessings upon blessings upon blessings. Take a look. Ben Purat Yosef, Ben Purat Ali Ayin, Banot Sada Ali Shur. It would take a whole shiur just to go through these words. So I hate to even translate them, but Yosef, he gets his new title. He's not only called Yosef, he's called Ben Purat Yosef. He gets a new title. Ben Purat Ali Ayin. And, Mikel Avicha v'Azrecha v'Shaddai v'Varachecha, you're going to get blessings of your ancestors. God is going to bless you. Birchot Shemayim Me'al, the blessings of the heavens above. Birchot Tehomra, that's his tachas. Birchot Shaddaim v'Racham. Beautiful state in the Siva Shalom. Slonim Rebbe on this parsha points out in these psukim, you look at the structure of the brachos to Yosef here, which is actually the same as the structure of the brachos Moshe gives to Yosef, the tribe of Yosef, at the end of the Torah in Vizos HaBracha. You see, these are not just random layers of brachos. He's actually saying Yosef's brachos stretch from the heavens to the earth and everything in between. How do we see that? We see here it's Birchos Shamayim, that's the highest one. Birchos Tahom, that's the lowest one, the abyss. And Birchos Shadayim Baracham, the middle of the body. So you have the top, the bottom, and the middle, essentially saying Yaakov gets all of the brachos. Sorry, Yosef gets all of the brachos from top to bottom and everything in between. He takes center stage. This is not just an elaborate bracha in terms of the length of psukim, but the layers and layers and the statement, the exaggerated nature of these brachos to Yehuda and to Yosef clearly show that they stand out leaps and bounds above all the other tribes. So our Parsha Vayechi, that structure of these brachos, confirms everything we saw emerge from Vayeshev and on. Just to review. In terms of the structure of the destiny of leadership of this family, we see selection, selection, selection. We get to the tribes themselves, the 12, no more selections. They're all in, but one needs to emerge as a leader, or two need to emerge as a leader. Reuven and Yosef get distilled as leaders. The others are not rejected, but they distill as leaders. They're the Bechors. Reuven is rejected, and therefore not rejected in terms of excise from the tribes, but in terms of his status of leadership, he's demoted. And then we're left with Yosef. Yosef at that point should emerge as the singular leader of the Jewish people. But despite the statement in the opening of Vayeshev, Eila Tolis Yaakov, colon, Yosef, the true progeny of Yaakov is embodied by Yosef. Despite that, the rest of the story tells a different story. The rest of that parsha and all the parshios till the end of Bereishis show not Yosef alone emerging as the leader, but Yosef and Yehuda together emerging as central figures in the family, central leaders in the family, central to the entire story. Almost as if the Torah is pointing us in the direction that Yosef and Yehuda are both the progenitors of leadership in the Jewish people. They're both leaders at that time and for all time, and they're vying for leadership. They're going back and forth, up and down. At certain points, one is the forerunner and one is not. at other points, another one is the forerunner. They're going back and forth here in terms of who's going to be the future leader of the Jewish people. And at the start of the story, at least, it seems like Yosef is the triumphant one. If you look at the stories from Vayeshev and on, if you buy my theory, and that Yosef and Yehuda seem to emerge as the leaders, Yosef is clearly emerging as the triumphant one from the very beginning. Right after those psukim of Eila told us Yaakov colon Yosef, we see in Parshas Vayeshev, Yisrael ahavis Yosef mikol banav, ki bem zukunim hulo vasalok son is pasim. Externally, Yosef is chosen. He's chosen by his father. He's the beloved one. He's the one his father chooses as the leader. He not only chooses him as a leader, what does he give him? A ksones pasim, a colored coat, a striped coat, technicolor coat. What is that symbolic of? The clothing of royalty. How do you differentiate a leader from everyone else? Well, their actions differentiate them. But even today, how do you differentiate a leader? Well, a king, a queen, they dress differently, they look differently, they have a certain clothing, they have a certain hat, they have a certain uniform. That's how you distinguish someone. He's given a coat specifically as a symbol of Yaakov's love and choice because it sections him off, it cordons him off as something different, as a king type, as a leader type. So he's chosen from the outside. Not only is he chosen from the outside, but he's chosen from the inside. Internally and prophetically, Yosef sees himself as a leader. Not only does Yaakov see him and choose him as a leader, but Yosef sees himself as a leader as well. And that emerges very clearly through his description of the dreams. By Chalom Yosef Chalom V'yaged Lechav Yosef Od Snoso, he dreams a dream and his brothers come to hate him. What's the dream? Hine anachnu me'almim alumim b'toch ha'sadeh, v'nei kama alum asi v'gam nitzava, where all of our sheaves of wheat representing each of us are all working in the field, and my sheaf emerges from the rest of yours. All of your sheaves come and they bow down to my sheaf. What is that symbolic of? Yosef's self-perception, or prophetically, self-perception, that he will emerge as the leader. He will be the one that they bow down to. So too in the second dream, Liachalom od chalom acher. He dreams another dream. And what happens in that dream? The sun, the moon, the celestial beings, all the stars representing you, representing our parents, they're all bowing down to me. They're all recognizing me as the leader. So both from an external perspective and internal perspective, if we're following the storylines of Yosef and Yehuda, Yosef is certainly winning, so to speak. Yosef is emerging as the triumphant leader. He's chosen externally. He's chosen internally by himself. He's recognized by himself as the true and natural leader of this family. And although it inspires the ire of his brothers and the hatred of his brothers, and he seems to fall from greatness as he's put in the pit and he's sold and all of that, in actuality, he's not demoted at all. He starts to rise in his own perception, and even as he's sold, he continues to rise, only in a different context. We follow the story through and we get to Egypt. What's the first thing we learn about Yosef when he gets to Mitzrayim? The Torah tells us he was an Ish Matzliach. He was successful. He was successful in Beis Potiphar, in a foreign context, with a foreign language. Coming as a sold slave, he emerges as an Ish Matzliach. That shows the power of Yosef as a leader to emerge from all downfalls to be able to emerge as something greater. Not only that, but he's given tremendous responsibility. He's given tremendous trust in the home of Potiphar. And by the time we fast forward to the arrival of the brothers after the story of the jail and getting out of jail, all of that, we learn Yosef hu ha-shalit al ha'aretz. He's the master of the land. Hu ha-mashbir l'chol ha'aretz. He's the provider of food for the entirety of the land. We see him rising and rising. He's clearly the leader. In a different context, but he is the leader nonetheless. Not only that, but even as he's continuing to rise as the leader in a different context, what the Ramban teaches us is that simultaneously he's trying to continue to emerge as the leader in his original context, in the context of his family with the brothers as well. The Ramban says the entire story of what happens with the brothers and all their trips down to Egypt and everything Yosef does to them to torment them, to accuse them of being spies, to capture Shimon and then tell them to bring Binyamin and all the backs and forths, and everything he does to them was not to torture them, but he does it for one reason, because he remembered the dreams. And in those dreams, he realizes he's destined to be the leader of his brothers. They bow down to him. And it could only happen when all of them arrive in Egypt to bow down to him over there. He orchestrates the whole plan to make sure all of the brothers would descend to Egypt and be there to surround him as the king, because he's not only destined to be the leader of the Egyptians, he's destined to be the leader in his family as well. The whole storyline, the whole thrust of the story is about Yosef externally, internally, building himself up as the natural leader of his people, of his family. The Ramban says over here, Kevan Shalara bin Yaminimai, in the original descent of the brothers, when he doesn't see, I should show you the pasuk first. Parshas Miketz, after it tells us he's the Shalit, etc., the brothers come, Vayakar Yosef Ezecha, Vilhem Lo Kiru, he recognizes his brothers, they don't recognize him. What's the first thing the Torah tells us? Vayizkor Yosef es ha-chalomos asher chalam lahem. He remembers the dreams. What does he do immediately after he remembers the dreams? Vayomer alehem miraglimatem. The first thing he does is he says, you're spies! You got to come here. You got to face me. One of you got to go to jail. You got to bring your other brother. You got to prove to me all the machinations of what happens for the rest of the story. The preface is he remembered the dreams. What does that show you? The Ramban says it shows you that all of these machinations were in order to make the dreams come to fruition, to show that he really was the leader of the tribes, the leader of his brothers. He saw in his dreams that all of the sheaves, including Binyamin, bowed down to him. And if now the brothers were in Egypt without Binyamin, the dream would not be fulfilled. Therefore, he wants them to go back and get Binyamin and bring him to Egypt so the dream could be fulfilled. This is why he doesn't reveal himself right away. He knows if he revealed himself, that he would ruin the moment. The dream would not be fulfilled. They would all bow down to him, but without Binyamin there. That couldn't happen. And then even after Binyamin comes, in the second round of their trip, what happens then? He says, oh, that's not good enough. Now you have to bring my father. So there's a whole plan here to try to get both dreams to be fulfilled. That's the Ramban says. So Yosef is emerging triumphant, moving up and up and up the ladder. At the same time, in all these parshios, Yehuda is very much on the descent. Yehuda messes up with the sale of Yosef. Yehuda messes up with the incident of Tamar. In fact, the Torah says, "Vayered Yehuda me'esachav." Parshas Vayeshev. After the incident of Yehuda v'Tamar, after the incident of the sale of Yosef, it says, Vayered Yehuda me'esecha. He descended from his brothers. He didn't just descend geographically. He descended in stature. If we're imagining Yosef and Yehuda as the two natural leaders with similar life stories in all these parshios, vying for leadership, all we see from the simple reading of the text is Yosef going up and up and up the ladder, and Yehuda descending the ladder. And that's the storyline. But Rabbi Soloveitchik suggests that despite the rise of Yosef as the natural leader in all of these parshios, and despite the seeming descent of Yehuda in all of these parshios, in terms of their status as the leader, the successor to Yaakov, the leader of the Jewish people, there is a moment when all of that changes. There's a moment when Yehuda surpasses Yosef and becomes the future leader of the Jewish people. And that moment, as you might be familiar with, is the moment of Vayigash. The beginning of Parshas Vayigash, as the brothers come back to Egypt, and as Yosef gets upset again, he sends them off. They find the cup in Binyamin's bag. He calls them back. He accuses them of being thieves, of being spies. And he wants to take Binyamin into prison. Yehuda steps forward and he says, Vayigash elav Yehuda. Yehuda approaches Yosef in a strong way and says, you can't do this. And he reiterates the whole story of what happened to them and how they got there and what he did to them and how they campaigned their father and how they're, et cetera, et cetera. So they can't leave Binyamin there. He emerges and goes to bat for Binyamin, for his family, for his father. And the Rav, Rabbi Soloveitchik, explains that that's the moment when everything changes. In fact, the Rav's theory about how everything changes in Vayigash, that moment where Yehuda steps up in a leadership role to defend the honor of his family and the well-being of his father, is confirmed by a very interesting medrash. The medrash, the medrash here in source number 24, cites the pasuk in Tehillim, "Ki neha malachim no'adu avru yachdav." The kings were destined to face each other and to battle each other out. Ki neha malachim, who are these, homiletically, who are these kings that pasuk in Tehillim is describing as facing off with each other? Zeh Yehuda v'Yosef. That is Yehuda and Yosef. And when do they do that? They do that in the moment of Vayigash Elav Yehuda. Echad be'echad yigashu zeh Yehuda v'Yosef. Vayigash Elav Yehuda is the moment of the battle between Yehuda and Yosef for the future leadership of the Jewish people. All this time Yosef had been in the lead. He was the forerunner. But at this moment, Yehuda steps up in a leadership role and surpasses Yosef in terms of the future leadership of the Jewish people. And Yaakov recognizes that change. He recognizes that shift, which really started earlier. It didn't start in the moment of Vayigash. It reaches the pinnacle in Vayigash, but it starts earlier. If you look back, Yehuda takes responsibility for the sale of Yosef when he tells his father, "I will take Binyamin, I will take responsibility for Binyamin, I'll take him down to Egypt, I will be the collateral for this child of yours, I won't let anything happen to him." He's recognizing his role in the sale of Yosef, and he's trying to make amends for it. In the incident of Tamar, he says, Tzadka mimeni. He's all these small stories of how Yehuda fails, but then he goes and he tries to fix it, he tries to better himself. All of those are small moments on the descent of ascent, where he emerges in small leadership ways. But it all comes to a head in the moment of Vayigash, when he steps up to go to bat for the family. Yaakov recognizes that. He recognizes that change, which is why in the brachos, in our parsha, Vayechi, he gives the bracha of Malchus to Yehuda. Despite the fact that Yosef gets a long bracha, Yehuda gets a long bracha, in the end of the day, the bracha to Yehuda is lo yasur shevet mihuda umechokek miben raglav ad ki yavo shilo. Yehuda will be the progenitor of Malchus. He'll be the one to take kingship. Now, it's important to note that even after the moment of Vayigash, even after the brachos of Yaakov, even after this point, Yosef still maintains a leadership role in the family, but not the ultimate leadership role, which goes to Yehuda. And therefore, he still gets extensive brachos in the end of Vayechi. Therefore, in the end of Vayechi, in our parsha, he not only gets many brachos, but he also gets the double portion. Yaakov gives him Shechem, Echad. He gives him an extra portion of land in the land of Israel more than the other brothers. That extra portion is exactly what a Bechor, the firstborn, the leader, would normally get. So he still has a vestige of leadership, a vestige of Bechor status. And not only that, but he still appears alongside Yehuda in a leadership role for the rest of Jewish history, for the rest of time. Not only does he appear together with him, but they appear in similar roles. They're both leaders. Yehuda is primary. Yosef is secondary. Just like in our story, Yosef is the leader, but he's the temporary leader paving the way to the true leadership of Yehuda, right? All along, he saves the family, he provides food, he's the mashbir, he's the shalit, he provides all this runway for the family to continue to survive, but ultimately passes on the leadership to Yehuda in the moment of Vayigash. That's the structure. He remains a leader, but he's the temporary leader that gives way to the permanent leader of Yehuda, which Yaakov calls the Mechokek. He calls him the leader. He calls Lo Yasur Shevet Yehuda. That's the same structure for the rest of Jewish history. Just think of a couple of examples as you go forward in history. As the Jewish people leave Egypt, they travel through the desert, they come to the land of Israel. Who is the king? Who is the leader? Who brings them into the land? Yehoshua. Yehoshua is from the tribe of Ephraim, from the line of Yosef. He's the leader. So Yosef, as a tribe, as an identity, still maintains a leadership role. He's still leading them in a very significant way. But Yehoshua is a transitional leader. By the way, who was next to Yehoshua as the co-leader, the second in command? Kalev. Kalev and Yehoshua were the two meraglim, the two spies that distinguished themselves from everybody else, that wanted to go forward to the land. Yehoshua from Ephraim, Yosef's line. Kalev from Yehuda's line. These are the two leaders. But in the transitional moment of moving from life in the desert to life in Israel, in the transitional moment, who leads? Who's the king? Yehoshua from the tribes of Yosef, from the tribe of Ephraim. That transition gives way eventually to the real kingship of Israel, which comes through David HaMelech. David HaMelech is, of course, from the line of Yehuda. So temporary leadership, Yehoshua, gives way to permanent leadership of Yehuda. Of David HaMelech, from the tribe of Yehuda. So just like in our paradigm, they both remain leaders, but they have different roles to play. Yosef as the temporary leader, paving the way. Yehuda as the permanent leader, taking it from there and going forward. So too in the future. Yehoshua from the Yosef line has a temporary leadership role. He brings them in. Very important, paving the way for the future mouthless kingship in Israel. And once they're settled and once they're established, the permanent kingship takes over, and that's David HaMelech from the line of Yehuda. The same thing with the Mishkan. The Mishkan was almost 400 years in Shiloh. Where is Shiloh? Shiloh is in the territory of Ephraim from the line of Yosef. When Shlomo HaMelech builds the Beis HaMikdash, the permanent structure, where does he build it? Well, it's sort of on the border of Yehuda and Binyamin, but mostly in the territory of Yehuda. So again, the temporary leadership in terms of a spiritual center is in the tribe of Yosef. The permanent, what it gives way to, the permanent structure of the Mikdash is in the tribe of Yehuda, and so on and so forth, all the way till the time of Mashiach. The Navi Yechezkel describes how in the time of Mashiach, we'll have the Eitz Yosef, Eitz Ephraim, and Eitz Yehuda, the merging of these two branches of the Jewish people. We have the concept of Mashiach ben Yosef, Mashiach ben David. The Mashiach, the Messiah that comes from the line of Yosef, paves the way. He initiates the process. He maintains a leadership role. But ultimately, the permanent leadership role, the real leader that takes us into that period, is going to be from the line of Yehuda. The question I'd like to end with before I open it for questions, of course, why? Why does Yehuda emerge over Yosef as the true leader, the true progenitor of leadership in the Jewish people? The Rav in this, Rabbi Soloveitchik, in this beautiful essay, which it's quite long, but a very important essay, he explains based on the Rambam in Shmoneh Prakim that there are really two personality types out there in the world, religious personality types. There's one which he nicknames or coins as the Chassid Me'ula, the perfect, righteous, saintly individual, the person who never has an inclination to sin, who in a second, as their natural inclination, always wants to do good, always emerges triumphant, that kind of perfect, saintly figure. And then there's the Moshe Barucho. There's the type of religious person that really struggles. They are pulled to sin. They are pulled to failure. But they overcome it. They work hard. They battle against it, and they emerge triumphant. And he says, in the end of the day, the Moshe Barucho, the battler, can come out as on as high a level as the Chassid Me'ula, as the saintly person. But it takes a lot to get there. So he says, the philosophers, they think the Chassid Me'ula, the saintly figure, that's the prime leader. That's who we want as a leader. That's why many religions hold up, you know, the saintly figures, the monks, the Nazarites, people who are separate, people who are holy, as the prime leaders of their people. But he says the Jewish view is exactly the opposite, that the Moshe Barucho, the one who fails, the one who struggles, but who overcomes those struggles, who overcomes those failures, is the person we want as the true leader of the Jewish people. That's the religious figure we hold up on a pedestal. That's the leader we hold up on a pedestal. The Rav takes these two archetypes. Rabbi Soloveitchik takes these two archetypes from the Rambam Shmoneh Prakim, and he applies them to Yosef and Yehuda. He says Yosef is the paradigmatic saint. He's the paradigmatic Chassid Me'ula. He's the person who never is tempted to sin. He's the person who's chosen, who's selected, who's perfect, who's elevated, who's different, who's separate, who never fails. He always seems to do the right thing. With Ashes Potiphar, he doesn't even struggle. He leaves. He never wants to be involved with her. In Egypt, despite the cultural influences, according to our tradition, he remains steadfast in his observance of his traditions of his family. He's the perfect person, never tempted, never fails. He comes to the worst situation of life. He's sold as a slave and he becomes an Ish Matzliach. He's accused of adultery and put in prison. He emerges as the solver of dreams, the second in command to power. He never fails. He's perfect. Yehuda is the quintessential Moshe Barucho. Yehuda struggles. He fails over and over. He failed with the incident of the sale of Yosef. He failed with Tamar. But at every single point, he recognizes it. He sees it. He pushes himself. He struggles to correct it, to overcome it, and to emerge even better than he was before. And the Rav says that's the kind of leader that we want. That's why Yehuda is chosen as the progenitor of Malchus, because the role of a leader in the Jewish people, the quintessential leader of the Jewish people, is not someone who's perfect, who rules with an iron fist from above, who's so different than the people that he crushes them, but a person who understands the struggles of people, who is real like people, who's dynamic and responsible and passionate like Yehuda was. Who fails, understands the lows of failure and understands the highs of triumph. Who is so in touch with the nature of people because he's exactly like the people. Only one difference. He pushes himself or herself so hard that they are able to emerge triumphant over and over again, even though normal people remain in the level of failure all too often. That's why he's chosen as the progenitor of leadership. There's much, much more to say about this topic. You can take a look at the source sheets more, some of the sources that I brought. But I think as we conclude, I can say that leaders are desperately needed today. The cultivation of leadership amongst our young people is desperately needed today. I think oftentimes we fail to cultivate that leadership because we go to two extremes. Either we expect perfection. We expect the Yosef model. We expect the chassid ma'ula. We expect someone who's perfect, and we never find that person. Or we expect so little that we appoint leaders who are so flawed, who are so tainted, that they can't lead us at all, that they can't inspire us at all. We either expect too much and therefore find no one, or expect too little and get no one who can truly inspire us. What we need is something in the middle. What we need is to shift to the Yehuda model of leadership, where we don't expect perfection from people, where we allow people to struggle, to fail, and to emerge triumphant from those failures, to learn from their failures, to succeed even more in the long run, and to be connected to the rest of the people in terms of those experiences, so that they can truly understand us and therefore truly inspire us and elevate us in the process. Thank you so much for being a part of this year tonight. Open up certainly for any questions that we might have. Thank you so much.
Thank you. There are a couple little comments on the chat box, and then people can chime in if they'd like.
Okay.
But if you want to take a quick look.
Sure. Okay, I see here, when we have a talented leader, the opposition tries to pull them down rather than find compromise and reach a consensus. We do not have respectful discussions on how to solve problems. So true. So true. I think, you know, there's a lot to say about that, why we try to tear down our leaders rather than try to talk to them. It comes a lot from insecurity. It comes a lot from judgment. It comes a lot from jealousy in some way. But there's a lot to say about that, but you're 100% right. I think we do have good leaders. Maybe the dearth of leadership is not necessarily because we don't have those leaders. It's because we don't facilitate the path for those leaders to actually emerge because we tear them down too soon. What about Yehuda saying Tzad Kami Meni with Tamar and before Vayigash was Anochi Avrenim? Oh yeah, exactly. As I mentioned, maybe you put that before I mentioned it, but I think the pathway towards Vayigash is laid by the earlier incidents of Yehuda, where he certainly emerges in terms of correcting his mistakes earlier on in the story. The one who struggles is Yisrael. Yeah, beautiful, right? Yaakov understood struggle. Yaakov understood failure. So certainly as a model of leadership in terms of Yehuda, what he passes on to Yehuda, that's already found in Yaakov, but Yosef emerges sort of as a different person, as the protected one, as the saintly one, as the one who never engages in those struggles. I see a direct message, not to get political, but cancel culture and ability for people to apologize and move on makes it difficult for good, normal people to become leaders. 100%. I couldn't agree more. And that's what I started with. I think the overexposed nature of our society and the cancel culture makes people never want to step into it. Like what I said in terms of my shul, I think people want to volunteer, but if they're in the leadership position, they know they can get shot down. Then they know they can, you know, be torn apart, and that's not a comfortable place to be. I think 100%, couldn't agree more. It's one of the main issues of our time and why people, I think, are hesitant to move into those positions of leadership. That's what I'm saying in the end of this year, is that we have to facilitate that path by not expecting perfection, but allowing leaders to be up there and to fail. And when they fail, instead of canceling them and tearing them down, see what happens. If they don't learn and they continue to fail, they continue to betray, and they continue to injure and to hurt, then of course you remove them. But if they're able to recognize it, like Yehuda did, and be able to see it, and to be able to learn from it, and to be able to struggle with it and admit those struggles, then they not only get the chance to try again, so to speak, and emerge even better, but they become instantly connected to each and every one of us. I'll say myself, none of you I can claim are failures, but I have many failures. But I can connect to a leader like that. And if that's true, I can rise with them instead of tearing them down.
There's no tshuva, that's what you're saying. You know, that's the problem.
Very much so.
The secular world doesn't recognize the concept of tshuva. You know, you run for a political office and the media will discover something you did 25 years ago that you haven't done.
That's,
you know,
right.
But I don't know why, but I still say it's before you were born almost, not really, but when, I don't know why this example always like sticks out of mind, but when Reagan appointed Bork, to be the Supreme Court Justice, so they say he was the most brilliant mind in America, but he admitted once in the '60s, he smoked marijuana. Like, I never smoked marijuana ever, but I didn't know what it smelled like till I got to YU, it's true, but it wasn't in YU. It was on the A train. I was on the A train. I was 20 years old. And I said to somebody, what's that smell? And he looked at me like I'm nuts. So anyways, but now I know what it smells like very much. It's legal and all that stuff. But, you know, he said, who didn't smoke pot in the '60s? So he admitted he smoked it once and that was it. He didn't get nominated for the Supreme Court. It's like unbelievable. Unbelievable. And
I don't know if you've ever seen it, but the last priestly host talk that Rabbi Sachs ever gave, Olav Shalom, it was the year before COVID, right? So it was like a
2019. I think I've seen parts of that.
It's on YouTube. It is perhaps his best, in my opinion, his best ever shir. It's his priestly host talk. He's wearing his talis in the shul, you know, before.
I've seen pictures. I know that I've heard it. Yeah, yeah. What is he talking about?
All about the cancel culture. He gives two incredible examples of people who are canceled for the tiniest offense and how Judaism doesn't believe in that.
Read that this week. I'm trying to, I know why. It was printed in the Mizrahi magazine. I happened to have the Russian, and I had never been, I was slipping through the pages just the other night, and had Rabbi Sachs's speech from the 2019 about two people, the Nobel Prize winner who made a joke talk, and that was his career. Well, today's Globe and Mail, for those who live in Canada, our national newspaper. There's an article about, you know, the University of Ottawa fired a professor last year, 2 years ago, because the professor in an academic setting was trying to explain how cultures develop and how people, like the way we took the word orthodox, you know, which was used as a negative term and turned into something positive. And she used the N word. And somebody tweeted that and the university fired her over it. And today in the Globe and Mail, she was a Francophone, Montreal, and the Quebec government just yesterday released a report on it they set up a commission who said that we have to enshrine in law academic freedom. And it said that 65% of professors in Canada admit they're afraid to use certain terms. 35% of professors don't even raise topics because you can get killed. And the university is supposed to be the place where Jonathan Sachs, in his book on morality, talks about how what he learned in university is how to hear people who totally disagree with him. And he loved that. Right. That's how he grew. That's what he gained from university, that you have to listen to opinions you differ with. So right. That's a problem anyways. Okay. All right. Anybody else want to talk? We don't have to have our own discussion here. Everybody else can say hello or add a comment or critique or whatever you'd like. Okay. Otherwise, please God, we'll see you tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. That's my share on the Siddur, or Sunday morning at 11:15 with Rabbi Liebtag. We quoted, of course, his famous Bechira and Bechora. Bechira and Bechora. They're the double themes. Who is the elder and the chosenness? That's the themes of Bereshit. Yeah. And then, of course, that's the whole book. And the original people, God chose all of mankind originally.
That's right.
We weren't going to have a Jewish people. Adam, and then Noah. And then it didn't work. So God had to narrow it down to Abraham's descendants. Okay. Bork had bigger issues. Okay. I don't know. Somebody tell me. Okay. Maybe I just, whatever the concept. I don't know. Okay. Yeah. Every time you mention something political, you get into trouble. there is no concept of Truba in the second world. It's sad. And then you have people who constantly sin and nobody cares. That's the craziness. That's the craziness of it.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. Laila Tov. Everybody, Shabbat Shalom and be well. Thank you very much. And say hi to all my friends in Camp Mill and all
thank
the best. Okay. Thank you very much. Shabbat Shalom. Bye bye, everybody.
Bye. Thank you. Bye, Milton.
Thanks.